let's take the one before the break then, because the truth is right out of this one.
Okay, let's go ahead and... can you move up here? I guess they're still doing the recording and netcasting and so on, so...
Yeah.
I'll be
I'm going to have to leave them out a little bit, because I'm going to use the whiteboard here.
That's fine. Just make sure you project loudly.
I don't know how many of you have seen the webpage I have about Jom. Basically, Jom is about pulling out the disk label and disk slice curve and making it modular in a staggable fashion. The idea is pretty old with the project, and we've had a implementation of it before that didn't quite make it. I have a prototype running now, and it's ARPA funded, so there's a very good reason to think that it will actually come through. It will change the semantics in some areas of the way we handle this, but hopefully the advantages of getting multi-architecture support for disk labels and stuff like that will be able to make people think this is still a good idea. There may also be a slight performance hit. It's too early to say that yet. I hope it will be slight. The way it works is that there are instances of methods which do transformations on the data. A transformation could, for instance, be a disk slicing, like a MBR or a BSD disk label, where the data is, the virtual disk that's provided is actually sitting in a different place on a physical disk below, and there's even a multiplexing going on. That's a purely translational transformation. We just move data around on the disk. More complex transformations might be putting a encryption in there, where the actual data is transformed. So that there's no limitation on what kind of transformation you can make with Jom, and there's multiple kinds of transformation, possibly all of them. So my hope is that we'll end up with a system where we have the Unix kind of one tool doing one good one thing well, rather than big complex lumps of code that try to do 20 things at the same time. A method may expose one or more providers. A provider is, in essence, the logical disk gadget. It exposes an interface where you can read and write a number of sectors of a given size. The size is determined by this module, and for now I assume all the sectors on a logical disk are the same size. The reason why it's rather flexible is that CD-ROMs have weird sector sizes, and we've probably not seen the last of those yet. Other methods can attach to these providers through a consumer. And the reason for the consumer abstraction is that we may have multiple consumers attaching to a given provider. Typically, all providers will have a dev method attached to it, because the dev method is what makes this thing show up in DevFS, where the user can actually access it. There's a locking mechanism involved so that you cannot open the same disk sector for writing from more than one place, at least if the VM system is involved. And there's an auto-configuration mechanism involved so that we do not have to run some userland program to get disk labels and stuff. The do-what-I-expect part of it should be auto-configuring on any platform. The native disk label format should be recognized and dealt with on the local platform. Whether we would want a i386 platform to automatically recognize a Spark64 disk label is a good question, or whether we would say, if you're doing something like that, you may have to run a command saying, go out there and look for anything, rather than just look for the defaults. There's some philosophical questions there we'll need to get some experience on and see how many, basically it's a question about how many false hits do we get. The locking method, I should probably talk about that a bit. When you open a device somewhere, there are three counters associated with it: read, write, and exclusive. And the way it works is that, for instance, mounting a file system read-only would open in read-exclusive, because we have the VM system involved. The exclusive bit prevents anybody else from opening from write. And these counters trickle downwards through the tree. If I open AD0S1A, these counters will trickle down to AD0S1 and trickle down from there to AD0 where we have the device driver and the tree stops. This is to protect for instance, a BSD disk label module which depends on the data on the disk to know where it should put data. If I have a partition open on AD0S1A, I should not be able to open AD0 for writing to modify the disk label, because I will invalidate the already open partition up here. I might move it around on the disk. So it will be legal to open AD0 for writing if you have opened something for reading that depends on the disk label. On the other hand, if I don't have anything open, I should be able to open AD0 for writing and go down and put a new disk label on it and have any other modules do the right thing. And there's mechanisms for doing that in GeoM that will, at least so far in my prototype, do the right thing. It's my intent that the modules that recognize on-disk formats should be endianness aware. For instance, the MBR module will know that the PC has a particular endianness. And I hope that we can get a convention where all on-disk formats are written in terms of explicit type sizes. It's 32, it's 64, whatever is needed for it. So that these modules will be working with the move a disk from one architecture to another and recognize the disk label still. I'll need some support from the people with architectures, because I only have two architectures in my basement right now, and only one of them runs 3BSD, to collect information about these disk label formats. In particular, one of the things I hope to do is, we have disk drivers now that start to do RAID mirroring and stuff like that, for instance, to Promise, Adaptic, and various other drivers. I would prefer to get that code moved out of the disk drivers and into a common RAID 5 module, for instance, a common mirroring module. But that will be, I will need some recognition of the on-disk formats again to do that. But hopefully the output of that will be that we can come up in single user mode with a mirrored root, also recognized from the median. I think that's the quick hitchhiker's trip to the GeoM system. Some of the things I'd like to collect some input on is I/O statistics. What do we want to collect of I/O statistics? Some other thing. Well, let's take that one first. Anybody got input on that? What kind of I/O statistics do we want to collect?
Great. Well, there are obvious things like the number of reads, writes, and amount of data transferred. But one thing that I think would be quite interesting would be a way of finding the busy time, the percentage busy time of each device.
Actually, the percent busy time I find pretty useless with things like tax queuing and stuff. I was actually thinking about trying to find the average response time instead.
Well, that's another one. I think, you know, it might be a challenge to get the average busy time, but it's not useless. It just might be difficult to find it. We can discuss how to find it. But
yeah.
So if we can.
Kind of a definition question, because do you count it as a time where there's something there, or do you count it how much is there too?
That's a detail we can talk about offline. But it would be nice to have that kind of information.
The DevStack code does keep track of how long a device has been busy, so you can. Basically, and busy defined as there's a transaction outstanding.
Yeah.
And I think somebody did some hacks to SysStat to get kind of a percentage busy number off of out in SysStat. So there is something there.
Yeah.
But to really get, I guess, a good measurement of, you know, how much I/O is outstanding and how long it's taking, you probably have to do per transaction timing, and that would give you transaction latency, but then you have to have somewhere to store the timestamp, and that's a bit of a problem.
One of the things there is an explicit cloning of the struct file. When you from the top, you come in with a struct file here, mm-hmm. and that struct file stays in this node. It will clone the struct file and send it on. It will be cloned and sent on. So you have a struct file for each edge in the graph.
Mm-hmm.
That's needed for recovery purposes and for restructuring. one of the things I want to be able to do is insert a transparent node. I want to be able to move a partition. And the way you do that is you insert a mirroring node, you give it a new mirror, you update the mirror, you remove the old one and remove the mirror node, and you have effectively moved your data from one place to another. But to do that, I need to be able to know where my bios are and where they should go on their way back, so that the ones that were sent down already will skip this guy on the way back up and stuff like that. So I do have a place to store it.
Okay, yeah, because you have to have per-transaction storage in order for that to work.
I do have that.
Okay.
The transaction latency stuff, though, just thinking back to Kirk's talk about the background FCK and it sort of hack to sleep for a certain amount of time
yes.
in order to reduce IO. You really, what you want to do is look to see what your response time is, and if it goes to hell, then you start banging people in the head. Instead of just... If your nice level happens to be at this point, you get to go to sleep for a while.
The problem is it goes to hell instantly. That's why.
No, it doesn't. I have some experience with response times from disk, and it's actually a very nice curve to just load on. Most disks today have a practically linear search time. Basically, your search time depends on the number of sectors you're skipping over.
There's a small
edge in the curve in the middle where it has on disk cache.
About 60% of the disk latency now is after you've skipped a track.
That's rotational latency, yes.
Yeah.
But that kind of factors out when you just look at how it depends on how long it's been. The seek time, not the rotational latency, but the seek time is linear with
the
sector skip.
The real problem that you have is for something like EPSEC, when you're skipping around the disk, is that you're introducing a minimum of, you know, like say 3.5 milliseconds of latency, which can completely disrupt someone doing linear transfer.
I know.
That's the real problem.
That's actually a piece of work that I want to try to see if I can integrate in this, a new disk sort algorithm that tries to avoid the this looks idle concept of disk sort. But that's not really related to GeoM. But the disk sort algorithm will probably be pluggable in GeoM at the time I'm done. So
okay,
we can play with stuff like that.
We shift a little on from that issue. Are there any other questions related to the work or things you wanted to raise? I have a couple of questions in my queue that I should probably wait to the media. Justin.
Well, I just have one quick question. You were saying that in this diagram here, if I open, say, AD0S1 read-only, the AD0 inherits that exclusivity bit.
Yeah.
Does it affect only a range? So for instance,
nope.
So I can't open AD0S2 read write?
Yes, you can. Because AD the typical disk layout we have today would be something like you have an AD0 driver, you'll have an MBR module, which may expose, say, two slices, and you'll have a BSD thing here, which exposes four slices.
Right.
So if you open this one to read only, that'd be basically a count 1, 0, 1.
Right.
Down here you will have a count of 1, 0, 2, because this one consists of having its own exclusive bit to protect the disk label. Same thing with this guy, so down here you will end up having 1, 0, 3. This effectively prevents you from opening this one for writing or opening this one for writing. Now, you may be able to open this one for writing. That policy is determined by this guy, and if they're not overlapping, he'll allow you to do that.
So the range of permission is actually here. That's what is determining whether.
Yeah, when you come from the parallel side, and this guy determines these are not overlapping, you can open it.
Okay.
But you need to protect it downwards to say he's not overriding my disk list.
Okay, Nick.
From the work you've done so far, do you have a figures for the performance test?
No, I haven't, because I've been doing most of it in userland in a kernel simulator shim. But the overhead is basically doing a allocation of a struct bio, copying 7 fields or something, modifying one of them, sticking it down.
Right.
So, I mean, it costs us 2 struct bio initializations more to do it this way than the current code. That is the effective test, including the scheduling of this thing.
Right.
Alfred, do you have a question?
Yeah, is there a way to bypass? I mean, well, one of the to modify the on disk label while it's mounted read only, is this going to be possible? Or
yes,
like
I mean,
still,
you go in and ask the BSD module, can you modify your disk label? because he'll be able to look at your modification and say no can do because you're moving an open partition around. Or he can say you're modifying a partition that's not being used for anything right now, so I'll let you do that.
Well,
but you cannot go down on the raw disk and modify the disk label.
I wouldn't want that to be completely exclusive, but sometimes you may need to do something like that. Like
then you need to do it at a time where it's not open.
Well, what if it's the root file? What if I want to expand the root file system? I'm going to have to.
But you can expand a file system. Making a partition larger while it's open is a safe operation as long as you don't move where it stops. That's an obvious, allowable thing to do.
Okay.
That will not be banned, but making it smaller will be.
Well,
because you will have to ask the file system if you're cutting out three syllable groups at that point.
Yeah. Okay. I understand it like being kind of exclusive. Exclusive blocks going on, but there should be like some way of banning it if I really need to.
Yes, but not while you have a file system open on it. You'll have to use your fixed block.
DVD, no problem.
I don't know what to say about that. Other than I think that's a bad idea. There will be problems. It's scary that our other bloodline management stuff like Venom allows you to force certain states, but it's coming in handy. And I doubt that the initial run of this is going to be.
The only thing that's going to be magic here. In any sense of the context, is you're thinking having your root file in single user mode.
Okay.
I mean, you can go into single user, and you can modify this tree to your heart's content, keep your modules out of the way, modify the undisk format. But I'm not going to make an escape mechanism for modifying the partition you have your root file system in while you're in single user mode. That's so small a market, and we haven't fixed it, floppy DVD CD-ROM, that. It's not going into the code just to cater for that special case.
Well, when you're deploying servers in like a data center, sometimes you don't have a block of CD-ROM or anything else. So being able to do that is actually pretty important. I mean,
What happens if you modify the disk label of your root files in single user mode today? You die. So, I mean, it's not a legal transformation to move an open file system around on the disk. You can't do it today, and you won't be able to do it with this one.
You can do it if you're clever.
Then you can compile your kernel with your own patch.
Yeah, okay, so I think we probably should move on from that discussion. I think it is worth noting that the policy is mutable because you can always change the module if necessary. So, I mean, in the event, this total system doesn't prevent you from deciding you're going to tweak the system to allow that policy to happen, since that lives entirely in, say, the BSD module. But
okay,
so we should probably move on, however, before getting too stuck in this one. Are there any other issues relating to this?
I'm just wondering what the namespace is, for instance, if I want to change the partition layout and I need to talk to this module, I'm not talking to /dev/ae0 anymore, I'm talking to /ad0/bsd, or, I mean, all these nodes show up in /dev, or how does it work?
The configuration interface, through the going in and forming to these guys, is probably going to be sys-control, and I'll probably allow semi-octals for backwards compatibility for some amount of time. But I want to get out of the business where we have all the device drivers knowing about BSD disk labels and having iOctals for them. I want that out. I haven't examined the necessary changes and what incompatibilities it would make to the disk label netdisk tool. I realize that netdisk is probably falling back to me when I do this. But netdisk goes down and right on the raw disk puts things right fit, so it won't really need to know about this. I haven't really decided on the namespace. The one namespace I care about this time is making sure that the things we have in /dev today are called the same thing in /dev with this system when I commit it. So that 80.0.s1a will still be 80.0.s1a. If we subsequently want to rename things, we probably need to take a more architectural discussion about what we want to call things down there. Because, for instance, if you have an auto-configuring mirror module, what name should it create for the nodes going upwards? Right now, names are inherited upwards. This one will name his provider here 80.0. This one will talk an S1 on it. This guy will talk an A on it. And you have the name construction. But what are we going to do with RAID and mirror and other such modules constructing the names? I have no idea.
We should Julian for his question. I have a very brief question that we should probably
Have you considered using the earlier discussed methods and inheritance and so on, so that the sub devices actually inherit all the way through the present new bus codes like all the other devices do?
I discounted K object for performance reasons.
Yeah.
I discounted NewBus for the simple reason that it doesn't provide it provides a strict one-way tree at this time, and I may have trees going both ways. You can have a module like a mirror which has two downsides, and you can have modules which have multiple upsides, and you can even have a module that has 10 down and 10 up. And NewBus doesn't support that at this point. The other thing is that the one thing we're having a lot of problems with right now is things going away. And I want a clear-cut mechanism for the device driver to say, I don't have a disk anymore. And I want that mechanism to work and do the right thing. And the right thing is not panicking. And ripping things out of the NewBus tree on the fly is not a polite operation. And I can't see it being robust enough that it will live up to the criteria here. What I'm actually doing in that case is that the provider is detached. The provider down here will be detached and marked for error. And the internal event system in this will trickle that event up and things will just dismantle themselves. I couldn't find a way where I could say I could do that reliably with NewBus.
How do you handle a case where the switch, because I mean, it's basically exactly identical to the stuff that was ripped out before by Equalize, so I've done this before. How do you handle the case when the device rips out at the bottom while you've got a downwards traveling request coming the other direction?
That's actually not the problem.
That's actually not the problem.
The problem is when you're in this node when it happens.
Yeah,
that was what was missing in the slides, was the locking there in order to make sure that you actually were at this state.
Yeah.
That's what we were working together.
Right.
There's two things to it. One of them is that a struck buyer traveling down here will at any one point be either connected to the consumer or to the provider. And that's where the locking primitive is. It's either on one side or the other one. And the other one is you can mark a provider as not accepting anymore. That's simply an error field. You can put in an error number in it. If you try to schedule a new buyer going downwards and that field is on zero, it will not come down there. It will be bounced off. Setting that error number field is an atomic operation. So once you've set that memory barrier, you will not get any more buyers. At that point, you can safely take that one out.
Well, you have to count the references, which I mean. If you look at all the transactions that are below you, you have to wait for them to go.
Actually, I don't, because the transactions which are below me have a pointer to the consumer they're going back to.
And then they don't
run
actually all the way up the tree.
Yeah, but they have to be finished by
they only go one level up,
driver.
Remember. I have a request coming down here. That one gets stuck here.
Right.
A new one gets created here, sent down there where it stops. A new one gets created here and moved down. So they only move one step up, which means the accounting is pretty simple. Do I have anything outstanding yet? No, it's a simple counter.
Right, but doesn't your counter have to be zero? Before you can go away.
First of all, the driver should decide.
This is actually the detail.
The driver needs to decide about that, whether it's going to flush before or after. Both things are possible. You can't destroy the consumer up here until all buyers come home.
Right.
Okay.
I think I'm not as familiar with that part of the subsystem as you are, but I'm wondering about couldn't you provide some sort of generic callback from the system so when the device actually goes away, you can walk the structure built by the BioQ disk sort thing and just or in the error flag and wake them all up?
They're sitting here.
It's just an idea.
Yeah, I do that.
Okay.
They're sitting here linked into a queue in the provider I kick. So everything that's on the queue will just get sent back. But I need to negotiate with the device driver writers about that. Whether the device driver writers want me to do that or whether they want to clean that queue themselves.
One of the ways you might be able to do it is to somehow export the device driver lock through that through this mechanism. So
that would give me overlapping lock, but
doesn't work. Let's not stick down too much into details there.
The issue very strong percentage is that the device driver may have information in that struct file they need to track down their hardware state. So I don't want to destroy them before they've had a chance to do that. That's the issue.
Okay, let's do Nick as the last question, and then we can move on.
Is this an implementation that's based on earlier research work, or is it something that's pretty much wholly new?
I've read out what I could find, but most of the things you can find are things like Veritas that has a big hierarchy where you start out with a physical disk, logical disk, sliders, places, da da da. They all have a fixed hierarchy, and they don't have, I've not found any that has a flexible, pluggable structure like this. With this one, you can mirror to a physical disk and then disk label them, or you can disk label them first and mirror them afterwards. So.
I'd be willing to take a follow up question.
It was a follow up question. Have you looked at the BIOS test? BIOS.
BIOS. No.
Because they had a fairly fancy filing system where they could put in journal file systems or UFSA file systems and move
them. Yeah,
but
you didn't. I looked at
these.
Okay,
so
there you go.
It didn't work anything like that.
Yeah, okay.
It wasn't that cool.
That sounds like a good response.
Okay,
I have to cut that off on the right. So, I get to ask my last question, but then we're done. actually, the question has to do with the 64-bit issue. I know when you and Kirk were talking about the UFS2 work, you were worried about 64-bit numbers spilling everywhere. Will this give us an opportunity to retrofit a bit of the system that will have to get 64-bit numbers, and you'll do so at this point?
My plan is that struct file will use 64-bit byte offsets and 64-bit byte counts rather than block numbers. I want the dev B size to be a thing of the past, although it's pretty universal, but I just want to get rid of it, okay? The other thing is, I want struct bio to be conditionally mapped. I don't want, right now, whatever you have in your struct bio is mapped into the kernel address space, and that's actually not necessary for most of our device drivers. So, my plan is that device drivers that want it mapped will have a call. They have to do is they call map this bio before they can assume that. And in the initial implementation, that would be a no-op because all of them are still mapped. But once we have them in the device driver, we can start doing things from, for instance, FIS.io, where we say, okay, we just have to make sure they're resident. We don't have to map them and stuff like that.
Okay,
and
now I get to cut you off again. So.
I've heard about that giving up to about 7% performance boost estimate.
Which will easily pay for the cost of sticking this stuff in.
I hope so.
Okay, so in that case, we get to move on. Actually, I should probably go to the phone, although I guess there's probably nobody listening on the phone at this point who actually has a question. But are there any questions on the phone? Good. They're probably netcasting, and Joe is probably hanging around somewhere, but there's no questions. We should probably move on now. Okay.
It's your stuff, I guess.
I think we have the net stuff in there. Oh, we do.
Yes, I
can. What are
Yeah. Okay.
Are we on time?
We're actually on time.
About 5 minutes over, I think.
Yeah, it's pretty close. So no food has arrived yet. Time for the break.
No.
Someday it will arrive.
Supposed to be.
Yeah, we may have listed. We're going to go ahead and do the network session now. So, Luigi, who wants to? Do we lose Jonathan?
Bathroom break,
please.
Well, if anyone else, if you need to go.
Let's
take a 2 or 5 minute break.
Yeah, why don't we take a 5 minute break? It's supposed to happen now anyway. And we'll, right now it's 25 minutes past. We will start up again at 30 minutes past, whether people are here or not. Lunch is at 1 o'clock. 1 o'clock.